Hey everybody, welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige. We're going to be talking about the 25th anniversary of the release of the Martin Scorsese. You say Scorsese, I say Corsese.
He changes it every time. Every time he says it different.
He does it. It's another way for him to get more of his family members into the film. You know, they have strict nepotism laws in Hollywood.
Yeah, strictly enforced nepotism laws. This is Corsese. Yeah. Corsese doesn't live with me.
Who said Scorsese? This is Corsese. Come on.
It's also to keep the FBI off his trail.
That's true. In fact, I'm going to be covering my mouth for the entire process because I've heard that they've hired. I've heard that they've hired lip syncers or lip readers. They've hired lip syncers and lip readers. That's the measure countermeasure that we got going on. I've gotten way off topic. We're talking about the 25th anniversary of the movie Casino. Mm-hmm. This thing came out November 22nd, 1995. It's been 25 years. Some people say that Casino is to Goodfellas as The Godfather 2 is The Godfather, a superior version of an already amazing film.
Wait. They say Casino is better than Goodfellas?
Yes, that's what many people say.
Forget
it. I'm not even we'll talk about that in a minute. But this movie Casino was based on a novel novel by Nicholas Pileggi, Casino: Love and Honor in Las Vegas. Now you might remember Nick also wrote the Wise Guys book that inspired Goodfellas, and just like that project, he also worked with Martin Scorsese to adapt this novel into a screenplay. It's based on a real story. He had tons of access to the real Frank Lefty Rosenthal that De Niro's Sam Ace Rothstein is based on. This guy owned and operated four casinos during the heyday of the mafia. Run of Las Vegas back in the late 70s. It stars, of course, Robert De Niro, Sharon Stone, Joe Pesci, Don Rickles, Kevin Pollak, and James Woods. And see, he's James Woods. God, I tried to make him James Wood. That's Elijah's deal. It's another one of those nepotism things. You know, you change something into a possessive or a plural, and boom, whole other entity as far as the IRS is concerned.
Yep. Wink. James Wood is his LLC.
Yeah. This is that's the movie. What'd you think of Casino? Have you seen Casino before?
I've seen it at least twice before this. So this would be at least my third time. I can't remember exactly how many times I've seen it though. Because it's a long movie and
it is.
Unlike some people, apparently, I don't think it's as good as some of Scorsese's other films, but it's still very good. Like, look, Scorsese's kind of in a league of his own when it comes to these mafia movies. And so even his, like, kind of mediocre efforts are still kind of amazing. I like this movie a lot. I think it's a, like, fresh look at the mafia scene. You know, that Las Vegas perspective kind of gives it life. I've seen so many freaking New York mafia movies, mm-hmm. right? All those can start to feel the same. This feels very different just based on its setting and its time period and its fashion, its lifestyle, like all of that stuff.
Yeah. On the other hand, it does feel a lot like a more gothic Goodfellas.
Yeah.
It is, broadly speaking, the exact same storyline. With largely the same cast of characters. I mean, they're different. They have different names and they're obviously in different locations and different lifestyles. But like, you know, Joe Pesci, stop me if you've heard this before, is playing a hothead gangster who can't be controlled and who undermines the success of the larger illegal operation. And Robert De Niro plays the tight-laced, efficient, straight man general. He's going to be brought down in part by his ego and his unstable relationship with women. It shares a lot of the same DNA, and I guess maybe we can start there. People say that Godfather 2 is unambiguously better than The Godfather. I don't know that I agree. I know we had this debate in a podcast, but like I go back and forth all the time.
Yeah,
like
me too.
you know, and to the extent that maybe Godfather 2 is greater than The Godfather, it wouldn't exist and even make sense in without the context of The Godfather. So it's like, well, okay, if it is better, then it's standing on 3 hours of superior filmmaking. So, like, it's hard. It's hard for me to give it the nod that way. And I kind of feel the same way. If Casino's better, it's better because I guess it's slightly more adult and it is less of a well-worn concept. You know, getting out into Vegas, you still got the mob connections. But, you know, instead of, you know, The Godfather is roughly the story of Michael Corleone trying to be Sam Rothstein, like trying to get to Vegas where he can go legit and start making, you know, start running a square deal,
yeah,
you know, and put this life of crime. This is the movie about how that falls apart.
Yeah.
I mean, it is kind of funny that even Michael Corleone got what he wanted at the end of God or in Godfather 2, it would all have come crashing down like a decade later.
Sure. No, I like it for that. Very much. I talked about this in our Goodfellas review, which we did not too long ago, how I really like the sort of like gangster on the come up story. This movie doesn't have as dynamic of a main character. Sam Rothstein is nowhere near as interesting as Henry Hill, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And so like, I don't have that instant connection to the film that I do with Henry Hill, like, because he's just a regular dude, right? He grows up in this area of New York that, you know, is filled with gangsters. And he sees a life and he gets enticed by it. That's a story that I could watch and I have watched many, many times over, right? But it's always interesting to me. And so when I say like, oh, this is fresh, it's also maybe not as intrinsically interesting to me. Because I can't ever see myself in Sam Rothstein, but you could see yourself in Henry Hill, right?
Yeah.
At the beginning of that movie.
Yeah, and they do enough like an early narration of this movie to establish that, like, if you know, Henry Hill is Sam Rothstein and they are outside the mafia organization. They're never going to be fully trusted. They're never going to be made men. And they form this childhood relationship with a person who is. So it's like, but you're right. Like an origin story is probably always inherently more interesting and exciting than like the winding up of one. You know, this is not how things begin. This is how things end.
Yeah.
And it's got, you know, established people, you know, dealing with like maintaining power rather than or some kind of rise to power.
Yeah. And I do like it for that. Like I said, I think this is a great movie. It's just not as inherently interesting.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Yeah, and it's like, it's really interesting because the three main characters, so you got Ace, he is this gambling expert. He is an expert handicapper. Like, he knows, and they kind of show you, like, he knows, you know, which quarterback is addicted to coke, which quarterback's blown out his knee, you know, which horse has got a swollen left testicle. Like, he knows everything. He's got all this information. Nobody knows how he gets it, but he is very good at making money betting on sporting events. And he's very meticulous, you know, like, but he's also got, as a result, a huge ego and, like a compulsion to control things. Mm-hmm. And he's thrown into these other two characters, Nikki, who is the diametric opposite. Nikki just wants to go and smash and grab all the time, yeah. Because he loves it. Not for any ends, to achieve any means. He just loves taking shit from people and beating people up. And then Ginger, played by Sharon Stone, is, you know, she's Elizabeth Shue from Leaving Las Vegas. It's funny. We kind of got into the Vegas gangster rut here without intending with these anniversaries.
Yep.
But she's what they call a hustler, sex worker. You know, like there's this one narration. I think Joe Pesci says she's good at keeping a man up for 2 to 3 days. And taking everything from him, facilitating the taking of everything from him, and then sending him back home to the missus, and just doing it again and again and again, and skimming off. And that's one of the themes in the movie, like the fact, the skim, everything's being skimmed at every freaking level with the mob running Vegas.
Yeah, but I've got some questions around that that I'm hoping you'll be able to help me answer, but we'll see.
I don't know, because I've only seen this movie maybe once or twice more than you.
Okay.
I did see it. But the thing is, what's interesting about these characters is they have a rock, paper, scissors relationship where they're all like weak to one particular person and strong against another, or they all just have these personalities that instead of leading into some kind of virtuous spiral upwards, it's always just this vicious circle that goes to the bottom, to utter destruction and destitution. And I thought it was really uncomfortable watching, especially in the third act when things are just going to shit.
Yeah.
You know, like, my God, Robert De Niro, I always think of him as this very strong character, and he is the weakest of men in this film. You know, he's just bluster and empty threats and ultimatums that he never enforces. And, it's interesting to watch.
I don't quite understand why that's the case. Like, from the very beginning, from the very start of this relationship between Sam and Ginger, I'm wondering what it is that he sees in her. What is the thing that, you know, they do the whole thing where, like, the music drops out and when he first sees her, and it's all eyes on her, and this moment of, like, instant attraction. She's flipping poker chips into the air and causing chaos in his casino.
She's a tornado in his casino. Yeah,
yeah, she's doing the shit that Nikki would do, and he'd be pissed off about it. I don't understand why there's any attraction here, and I don't think the movie ever explains that. It just kind of says, hey, this is an attractive woman. She's kind of got this crazy streak, this wild streak, whatever, and is it like he's trying to tame a stallion? What is this thing? I don't understand the attraction.
I really think that's what it is. They all have this thing where, like, why does Sharon Stone stick with her pimp, you know, that's picked her up when she was, I guess, 14 and have some kind of mind control ever since? You know, why does Nikki, who can make money 10 different ways in Vegas, have to threaten the head of a bank who is like a civilian, is going to run to the FBI? Why? Yeah. And Nikki at least provides an explanation in that scene. He goes, I'm going to do all these things, even though I'm going to go to jail. And as soon as I get out of jail, you'll be coming out of your coma and I'm going to crack your skull again. You know why? Because I'm stupid and I'm crazy. And I think that is the answer. Like, I just saw this movie, like, whenever we recorded Goodfellas, I saw the movie that night because Cecily is like, I got to see this Casino. Like, we're on a really Scorsese kick. I'm like, all right, wow. I haven't seen Casino in a long time. That's right. Like, the next week I realized I'd have to be watching it again and taking notes. I'm like, damn it. This is a long ass movie. But it did give me this perspective because I was asking all these questions and they were still in my head. So I was looking. And what's funny about this, just like The Godfather, just like any kind of complex adult, you know, narration, every time I watch this movie, I feel like I get a new wrinkle out of it, and things that I thought might be like flaws and narrative mistakes are turn out to be a strength or a hidden complexity that I didn't appreciate on the first few viewings.
Okay.
So I think this thing rewards rewatching quite a bit, and there's a lot of things that are entertaining about it. It's just like, yeah, there's a certain part of this movie, like in Goodfellas, like if you want to, you can stop watching this movie at a certain point and it's kind of a happy ending. And I think it's right before Ace fires the slot machine guy.
Yeah.
Like it all. Yeah. But the other thing that makes this engine work is like, so you've got these three people that are stupid, you know, like why can't Ace just, Ace pays off everyone and everyone's on the skim. He lets Nikki do it. He lets Ginger do it. Why can't he let this stupid slot machine guy get his skim on? Like, maybe, yeah, he lets three jackpots win 15 minutes back to back to back. Maybe you put him in charge of the blueberries in kitchen. Mm-hmm. But why? Why do you have to have this pointless pissing match that you know you're going to lose? And every decision he makes since that to escalate it gets him in trouble with the fucking bosses. And they all do it.
No, it's like, it's some of that street versus, like, establishment. It's the East versus West kind of thing. There's very much like a cowboys versus city folk sort of string running through this movie, because like, you know, that dude comes in with the fucking turquoise bolo tie that it's enormous, it's like, I don't know, huge, the snakeskin boots, and he's like all this, you know, western swagger, like this cowboy energy, and I think Rothstein takes a look at him and goes. And they do this thing, too, where they're, like, contrasting their footwear. So, like, first of all, Sam's sitting at his desk with no pants. And seeing Robert De Niro in those stockings and blue shoes is not something I wanted.
Yeah, he's doing the, Jesus Christ, the Sean Connery.
Absolutely.
Rest in peace.
But then when the county commissioner walks in, they don't show his face right away. They start on the shoes and the snakeskin boots versus the shiny polished blue leather. I don't know what Robert De Niro is wearing. It's a nightmare. But you know, they're contrasting their styles and where they're from and, you know, their attitudes and all of that stuff.
Oh yeah. And you know, but the thing is like they also make it a point that like Ace should know better. Like he is running he's running a casino without a casino license, and he's got maximum exposure. The heat that Nikki's put on him is like, just let the guy. And the guy comes in and it's like, I thought, like the first time I watched it, I'm like, well, maybe I'm going to be on Ace's side, but because the guy's going to come back and like, look here, you fucking Italian Jew pissant, slur. Mm-hmm. You're going to take my nephew back and you're going to put him in charge of the fucking poker tables as well as the thing. He came in and be like, hey, look, man, I know this is some misunderstanding. And the kid's a tough luck case, you know? He's a tough luck case. I don't expect you to put him back on the floor, but can he count the garbanzo beans in the salad bars? Can I just get him paid? Can we just get our beaks wet here? And Sam just fucking big times him. And it reminds me, man, this happens so much. Like there's these things that Scorsese does, and I know I saw it in Gangs of New York, which I watched earlier this year. I saw it in The Irishman, which I watched. I've gone Scorsese overload.
We can fit
Raging Bull in here before the end of the year. We get the whole fucking thing complete. But he keeps doing this thing where it's like there's this fatal flaw of pride, where you know, just like Jimmy Hoffa could not back down when he hit the end of his rope and is going to get him killed. Ace, there's like multiple occasions where it's like there is a place where you can go and allow a person to do the thing that they've been doing the whole film, like skim. Just get a little bit, just take a little bit off the top and you'll be fine. Or get the fuck out and go back to being a bookie. And he just doesn't do it.
It's the thing that got them there is the thing that ultimately brings them down, right? Like, you know, you got to have that don't never back down spirit to get to the place they got to. But then also,
I guess that's true.
You ride that thing right over the cliff.
Yeah, there's the you get promoted to the point where you're out. If you're doing a job and you do it well, you get promoted. But eventually, you know, your capacity to keep doing a job well is going to be exceeded, and you get promoted to where you're now incompetent and you can't keep the job. It's interesting. Do you want to, like, because I've got some of my notes broken down and kind of like art, thematic, character analysis and stuff. Do you want to kind of do some, I kind of want to talk about the art of this film, because Scorsese is, he can make a beautiful film. I think The Gangs of New York is a beautiful film. But some of the stuff, like, this is not a conventionally attractive, like, you know, and he doesn't even do like some of the showy stuff he did in Goodfellas, like the long single tracking shots and whatnot. But one of the things I thought he did, which I was endlessly entertained by, is the narration system.
Yeah.
Where it's like this dueling banjo kind of thing between Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci talking about their perspectives and how it's different. And we're going to be getting into massive spoilers from here on out. So if you haven't seen Casino, please, on its 25th anniversary, check it out. If you're at all into like gambling or gangster movies or whatnot. But the it's interesting because it gives you these guys like joint perspectives on what's going on, and it allows you to be a lot more informed about, as an audience, about what's probably going to happen. But what I think is really great is when, like, there's a few fourth wall breaks, like at some point out of nowhere, one of Jimmy's handlers is getting pinched by the big boss, and he's saying, look, I need you to be straight with me. I need you not tell any, is Nikki out there fucking Sam's wife? Mm-hmm. And like it freeze frames. And then that guy starts being like, hey, I'm Frank. You probably don't even know my name now, but hey, here's what I'm thinking. I'm pushed between. And it's great. It's really great. And then when Joe Pesci is going to the meeting that's going to get him killed, it's like he's narrating him walking into that room, getting to be a made man in Goodfellas, and his stream of like, yeah, and you know, I've straightened things out like I knew I could. And then the baseball back to the back of his knee shuts him up.
They cut the narration there, right? Like they interrupt the narration with the baseball bat, which implies to me that he's narrating all of this in his head, because everybody else could, like Robert De Niro's narration in this is Sam Rothstein after the fact sitting at his bookie desk going over this history, right?
Yeah.
So he's sort of standing there reliving his history. Does he know it's coming in some way? Is that like...
It's really messy. It's because, it's like it feels like it breaks the laws of time and space, because obviously they're reminiscing during a lot of these films, and then like they're just doing it until they die. I liked it because it doesn't make strict sense, but it is interesting. And it's one of those things, like one of the few flaws I have in this movie is I hate the way it begins. Like
So do I. That pink suit is awful. Good God.
I'm talking about like, you know, this, it feels like American Beauty where, you know, you establish some guy is going to die at the very beginning. And just imagine that like at the end of the American Beauty, you find out, oh, actually, I survived that and I'm living and I'm doing fine. And I'm doing.
Yeah.
Like you showed me this car blowing up. And Ace is just flying, his body, his corpse is flying through the air, being ejected from his vehicle. Fuck you, Scores.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but I don't know, because I, like, if I watch it one more time, will I realize something? Because at first I thought some of this narration was a flaw, too. Like, it's like, this is like Blade Runner shit. It doesn't really work. But then, like, it's used for comic relief a few times. It does break that fourth wall. It feels messy in the same way that kind of uncovering a he said thing should feel. So,
yeah. The thing I always like about these narrations is it gets you into the spirit of the scene. You know, like, you'll be talking about, you know, like The Irishman, where you got, you know, Robert De Niro's character, I can't remember his name, you know, offering the meats up to, you know, some gangster, and he's going over in his head, right? Like, you know, they'll never notice. And if they do, I'll just tell them, you know, fell off the back of the truck or whatever. You get into the spirit of those scenes a lot more with the narration.
Yeah, I agree. Another thing that I get a kick out of is watching Martin Scorsese work his mom back into a couple scenes, just playing this old Italian mom. Mm-hmm. And she's like cooking meatballs in the background. She's like, her face when she, every time some dude says the word fuck. Yeah, like I almost wonder, like, did he have to coach her to do that? Or is he just like, my mom's never heard the F word in her life. I'm going to sit this camera and start, and I just know I'm going to get gold from her. But it feels completely... It feels completely natural, her just scolding these, like, now what did I say about... It's great. It's great. I love it.
It's almost like she's not acting, but she's got to have heard, right? Like, he does this in every movie where he's got the scene where the kids are being completely inappropriate and the mom is going, oh, shame on you kids. So yeah. Clearly that's a part of everyday life in the Scorsese family, right? So she's got to have heard or a couple fuck words.
These are Italian-American families, I guess, because it's like the same thing. We just saw this in Fargo, too. Like, you know, the mom coming out and scolding, you boys, you doing your bad stuff. And, nah, come on, we're talking business. It's just the way it goes. Not all Italian-Americans, of course. A very small percentage of the family. But I also really like some of the camera work he does. Like, I noticed this time around, the camera follows the money. Like, even when there's a scene where Robert De Niro flips a envelope of cash on a diner table in front of this pimp, and like both the pimp and the camera look down, like the camera can't tear its eyes off of the money because that's the whole thing. Like, everyone's skimming, but everyone skimming is outraged that the next person is doing the skimming.
Yeah.
From the very tippy top of the bosses to the guy that's carrying the briefcase, like, hey, why can't I get my expenses reimbursed? I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm paying you thousands of dollars to go out to Vegas and bring back money. I'm going to start keeping records on that. I can't believe I'm getting ripped off. Like, it's amazing the way they tell the story of everybody got their hand in everybody else's pocket. And everybody's looking back in their own pocket like, the fuck is this hand in mine? It's amazing. It's amazing. I love the way the camera is dynamically just doing. Like, if there's cash or chips on the table, the camera is going to focus in on that. Just so, like, it feels like the film itself is hungry, you know?
Nice. Yeah, I didn't notice that.
Then there's the wardrobe.
Oh, boy, is there the wardrobe.
Robert De Niro's wardrobe is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen.
I love like it that, and I hate it.
I'm much more in the love column. By the way, lots of talk about robes in Bald Move of late and my love of robes. Robert De Niro's robe game in this movie with matching silk pajamas is something that I can only aspire to.
Yeah.
Like, Hugh Hefner wishes he had this robe game. Robert De Niro has got it all, man. It's the patterns, it's the materials, it's the colors, it's the coordinates. This is a fancy, fancy man. And I love the little detail of, like, him putting on his pants when the county commissioner comes calling. Like, Robert De Niro's got really nice legs, and he's got these silk stockings pulled up to his kneecaps. Like, there's some kind of front. It's an interesting detail of how fastidious this guy is.
I thought he had chicken legs, but that's just me.
Yeah, did you? I thought it's like, you know, I bet Robert De Niro put you know, it's been a couple of years since Raging Bull. I bet he
bulked up his legs.
Did some leg presses. Yeah. Got those things sculpted and toned as he knew he was going to be walking around in stockings.
Maybe. He's an older man. So of course. That's 25 years ago. He's older still.
That's true. That's true. And he's really old now. It's like, that's something I was like, God damn, I was just graduating high school in this year. And I'm definitely a lot older than that. And 25 years since, I'll be really moldy. But a couple other camera tricks I know, there's a Coke snorting cam where the camera's actually in the rolled up dollar bill, seeing it like the line being inhaled into it. And they do a lot of that it gives, again, the film and this feeling of having an appetite for these things that I really liked.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
And there's a couple scenes like, you know, that scene where Robert De Niro drives out to the desert to meet Joe Pesci, like to kind of kick off the third act when things are getting really bad. That thing's a fucking clinic, man. Those guys are going it's a 10-round championship prize fight. And Pesci wins it because that's what the script says. But like, how Robert De Niro and how either of these guys can act through these enormous windshields that they're wearing over their faces.
Yeah. That's what I mean about the fashion. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Yeah. I got to remember it's the 70s.
But that scene, I think it's like every time I see it, it's like it's this amazing thing because they're both going toe to toe and they've had so much hurt and resentment that's built up. And they're both blaming each other for each other's mistakes. And at the end, Nicky has to win the fight because he's the made man. And, you know, De Niro ends up in a hole and there's nobody anything can do about it. So, like, De Niro kind of, like, his face turns to granite and he like looks off into the middle distance and he just accepts this torrent of abuse and threats from Nikki, and he has to. But like, goddamn, when Nikki gets in his car and he peels out and that dust cloud, like, De Niro still hasn't moved. He's still sitting there maintaining that frame, and the dust cloud just kind of washes over him like a sandstorm.
Mm-hmm.
That's a beautiful, like, this movie's kind of shot ugly, but that's a hell of a shot. That's a hell of a scene, a hell of a shot. I think it's the best one in the movie, for my money.
Yeah, it's good. I also just appreciate the dynamic that those two actors have together, and you know, they've been on screen several times.
Yep.
And the way they interact, it's that scene, and then it's another scene where they're at Robert De Niro's house, and I forget exactly what's happening, but they're having another argument. I think it's later in the movie. And it might be around the time that Pesci is deciding whether he's going to kill De Niro or not, or, you know, Nicky's deciding whether he's going to kill Sam. There's an improvisational quality to it. Like, these guys have been through this scene so many times that now they can just kind of wing it. And I don't know if that was intentional, if that actually happened, if it was improvised, or if it was scripted.
I know that Goodfellas was a lot, and I imagine this is the same way. Like, which F words were in what porn and script, and you know, like, yeah.
So, but if you feel it, right, you feel like this is an actual conversation, a heated conversation between these two guys who are longtime friends. You know, Nikki mentions I've known this guy 35 years, right? And you get all that sense of, I don't know, pent up frustration and anger and affection and just like all of it.
And I like the way that Scorsese writes these scripts, and that like both of the characters always have points. Like, a lot of times when there's an argument, there is a preconceived like winner and a preconceived loser, and like the loser feels like they're playing the part they need to get into the losing frame. Whereas this, it's like, you know, he is stupid, but he's not stupid. Like when he comes at him about his wife, and Ace's like, "Hey, it's my wife. You stay out of my business." It's like, "Oh, I got to stay out of your business. You wanted me in your business a week ago when I was tailing this broad and like beating the shit out of the pimp that was, you know, just taking money from her. But now you want me to be like," that's a legit point. Like, you can't retreat behind this pomposity and grandosity, then say like, "Mind your own damn business," when you've been getting like, and there's some real hurt there with Nikki. It's like, you know, you always come crying to me when you need someone's skulls cracked, or you need someone to be followed, you need some dirty deeds. But then it's like, oh God, Nikki's caused me so much problems when I'm doing my thing to survive. It's interesting. And the thing that I love, like, it's funny, he's even got the same name. Like, my relationship to Tricky Nikki is like 95% less psychotic and all the other stuff that goes in, but like the fundamental energy is exactly the same as De Niro and Pesci in this movie.
Nice.
Like, I swear to God, we laugh about it all the time. Sometimes we do like pretty elaborate like casino type conversations just to escalate it for fun. But it's it's a lot of fun.
And there's,
that's one thing that I've, since I've got become his friend, that's something that's been extra juice with the watching the movie.
And there's always like a feeling of being on Sam's side, I think, in a lot of this, because Sam is a more generically stable person, right? He's not the guy who's going to go out and beat somebody for the fun of it. Or, you know, has this perfectly good life that he can then go ruin by wanting more or wanting something else to excite it, whatever. But at the same time, like, Sam causes a lot of his own problems here. And I think that's part of the film, right? Like, I mentioned, like, what does he see in Ginger from the very beginning? Well, if he's just trying to tame this wild horse of Ginger, that's an instinct that is going to get him into trouble. And then over the course of this, like, the way that escalates, the way that he can't let her have anything of her own, you know, she's going to be his. I mean, the whole marriage from the very beginning is ridiculous, right? He proposes to her. She says, "I don't feel anything for you like that." And he goes, "Well, that'll grow eventually, maybe." Or so I hear. And So he's marrying a woman who only wants him for his money in the first place, and then he's surprised when things don't turn out like he hoped. He's a fool in that regard.
And he's like trying to trap her in this marriage, like, you know, like, hey, here's all these jewels, here's your golden parachute, but I'm going to keep it under lock and key. And they, I mean, there's always like, you can gesture, I think you can watch this, and I'm sure there's people to watch this and they're totally on Sam's side, like, well, you know, what are you going to do, giving her money when she's got, and like, things got this bad because every, you know, every attempt, like, again, why does he give a shit that she wants to give her pimp $25,000? Like, if you wanted a $25,000 chinchilla, it would be fine. But, like, to make this guy go away, why doesn't he do it? And it's the exact same question. Like, I think you can't understand Nick. You can't understand Sam's relationship with Ginger without also applying the same analysis to Nikki. Because there's another wild horse that he can't possibly ever break.
Yeah.
And he could also, like, there, you know, he could either there's two solutions to both of these problems. You keep giving him their skim, or you walk away. And he fucking, like, his principles offend him to keep giving these people the skim when they don't. It's like, there's this scene in the movie where, you know, after they had that fight in the desert, Nikki's like trying to prove a point. And he's like, I'm going to run up a debt and I'm going to take a 50,000. I'm just going to steal 50 grand from, I'm banned from this casino. I just threatened my best friend with his life, and I'm going to go into his casino and I'm going to lose a bunch of money. I'm just going to steal 50 grand from him.
Yeah.
And he could do, I think if he did, like, you know, and then like, there's two schools of thought here. If he gives him the 50 grand, Nikki could just be outraged and take him for another 50. And then it just escalates until like, what are you going to do? Give him a million? I guess I'd argue, give him the fucking million. There's no limit. There's no limit to what you should give Nikki to make the situation go away. But, and then maybe walk away so you don't end up dead next time. But he can't do it. He gives him $10,000, which ends up getting Don Rickles' face bashed in. And, you know, it was one of the bad times I have in the third act of this movie. But I just never, like, every single time I'm like, okay, two choices. Keep doing the thing you've done to keep this relationship, this busted relationship, wheezing a few more miles down the road, or walk away. And he can't do either one.
Yeah. And it's not just the money that he uses as a tool to keep Ginger under his thumb as well. It's the kid, right? Like, they kind of gloss over it. They're just like, oh, and I made sure we had the kid before we got married. That's huge. That, and that's the only line you're putting in about that. And then, it turns into this massive thing by the end of the movie. The mechanisms
that,
of control.
That shit's
there.
Hard to watch, man.
Yeah, that's... you know, money doesn't have feelings. Money doesn't have a future. Money doesn't have a life to live. This kid does.
Yeah, and it's going to be a fucked up one. But that doesn't mean it's like a Rubik's Cube. So it's like you're analyzing Sam, now turn the cube over to Sharon Stone. Why can't she quit this pimp?
Yeah,
Can't she just... Why does she have to...
It's a lot of the same reasons that Sam can't quit Nikki. Exactly. Because they've known each other forever. They get each other, right? There's something about that relationship.
Right. And why does Nikki always have to escalate? Why can't he be happy with the thing he's doing? Why? And to the extent where he starts, like, he throws all caution to the wind in the tail end of this movie. And there's like a lot of little flashing red lights the narration provides. Like, yeah, Nikki stopped asking permission for all the stuff he's doing back home. And he was like acting as if he was the boss of Las Vegas, and the bosses of Las Vegas and Kansas City were ignorant of that decision. Mm-hmm. Like, why does he have to do those things? And it's like, that's the thing. Like, this movie is just a really deep meditation on how flawed people are and the need to control people, and like the toxic side of love where I love this person so much that I can't let them go. I literally can't let them self-destruct. And I'm going to let them take my money. I'm going to let them take my kid. I'm going to perhaps let them take my life down with it, because I just can't get away. And there's like, oh my God, that scene where she takes her kid off to where Ginger steals the kid, goes off the pimp to live in Beverly Hills or whatever, doing blow right in front of this kid.
Yeah.
A pimp smacking her kid, finally gets her back home. You know, and the night they get a babysitter, they get out, and this 25 grand is stuck in his craw. Like he said, she asked him, like, okay, I gave him 25. Can you forgive me for that? And he's like, if it's just 25, I can forgive. But he can't.
Yeah,
he can't. He's got to say, oh, you bought him suits, huh? How many suits? That's awful. $1,000 suits. Wow, you got fitted for 25 suits in 3 days. Oh, I bought him a watch. Oh, a guy like him, what's he get? A guy like him buying a watch he thinks is good taste, which he won't. Like, it's just like, what the hell is he doing?
They're both antagonizing each other. Like, going out to California with this dude is a huge antagonization. And yeah, she knows it. She knows exactly what she's doing, right? She, yep. It's not like she just wanted to go live a life with Lester. She also wanted to stick it to Sam, like,
because that's what she knows. Is she knows, like, the only way she can do things is to. But that's the thing. It's like, again, you know, like, I feel like it's easy to be hard, and because she is definitely doing the most. I mean, well, I don't know. Nikki's killing people with his heads and vices, but yeah, like, yeah, you know, doing drugs, taking your kid and exposed, like, there's a lot of beyond the pit, tying your kid to a bed so you can go out,
dude,
and do drugs. Like, it's pretty fucking beyond the pale shit. I don't know if it's any more or less worse than the other guys are doing, but like, it's not, I like, because you use the word like she's choosing to do these things. I don't think any of these people are making choices. They're just literally like machines that have to do the things they do. There's no self-introspection to be like, okay, she shouldn't have done that, but I took her back, and taking her back means forgiving her, maybe getting her to a treatment set. No, what I'm going to do is just like go right back into that dynamic because I can't let it go, because it's not about the money. Yeah. It's about the control and about feeling out of control and how I can never allow that to happen. But it's wild that he picks his best friend to be Nikki and his lover for life to be Ginger. Two people that'll never give him that safety and security.
Yeah. Speaking of that, crazy. That vice scene where he squeezes a guy's head in a vice.
Jeez, yeah.
They have a line in there, and I watched the Amazon Prime version of this, and I don't know if there are different versions, different cuts, whatever. They have a line in there, though, that says something like, oh, you make me pop your fucking eye out for this name, Charlie M, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't show the eye popping out, and I seem to remember a scene where they show the eye popping out. Did that get cut from this movie, or did it never exist?
I think it might have gotten cut. I don't think it's cut from this version. I don't, because I remember I had forgotten about the scene when I watched it with Cecily like 3 months ago. And when they put that guy's head in a vice, I'm like, oh fuck, I forget. This is like a gruesome thing that's happening. And when I thought for sure we were going to see it, I bet that the MPAA, like, because you could tell they had an eyeball ready to ball the blow, and it was kind of bulging. But like, I think I read some trivia somewhere that they had to like cut 30 seconds out of this movie to get it to slide in as an R. Because
yeah, of the that cursing was and the violence, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, I don't know why you can do that shit in Saw.
Yeah,
but like in like a movie like this, you can't, you know, like, especially when the shit that they do, like, there's a couple of executions here that's some of the coldest shit I've ever seen. Like Pesci coming into that old lady who's trying to get her money out of the casino and just grabbing her head and pop, pop, pop. The use of baseball bats and hammers in particular in this movie, it's all extremely gruesome and graphic, and it kind of comes out of nowhere. Like that first smashing fingers with a hammer, like, it's the movie's still in good time mode. Like, hey, look at the swingy Rat Pack shit. And I'm taking you behind the scenes to show how all the skim's working and all these and it's like fun, like your butt. And then they're going to drag. And then they get the circular saw out. And you're like, where is this go? This went from zero to fucking Saw in 30 seconds.
Literally.
And it's still kind of played for laughs, right? When De Niro drags the other guy in there and be like, all right, you can have your 100,000. And you can get the hammer, or you can walk out now. And the guy's like, yes, sir, I'll take that deal. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's crazy. I don't know. Is there an eyeball? Is there an eyeball pop cut? We need to find
it. There's got to be. Otherwise, why have that line in there?
The other thing that I appreciate, I don't know if you, what you thought. I thought that there was a lot more blame to be put on Nikki. And when I've watched this movie for the first time, like, you know, like, clearly if it wasn't for Nikki, that Ace probably had been okay. And in the two watches I made since that, I've kind of moderated that opinion.
Yeah.
Because I thought, like, okay, Ace, Nikki went out to Vegas because he was hiding from heat from the East or whatever. But there's a very brief scene where I think his name is Remo, the boss, the head of the, you know, the actual guy who's running shit,
says, Kansas
I
City.
Need you to, yeah, I need you to take keep an eye on Ace, because he's a good boy, makes us a lot of money, but you know, he's a Jew and he's not an Italian and we can't trust him, and you know you're a good Italian, but like, he's like, Nikki's there's a scene that then he kind of like, because Ace is his friend and Ace is running the town, he kind of ask for permission, like, he's like, he does it very diplomatically and delicately, but like, he's It's not like he came out there for wild hair and did it. I think it was his job. And, you know, he's got just like he can't, you know, just like Ace and Ginger can't walk away from shit. Neither can Nikki. But like he was given a job to do and he's trying to do it. And I don't know.
Yeah,
I think I'd have less sympathy because he's just so overtly stupid.
Sure. Sure. Sam wants to play it straight. Nikki doesn't.
I mean, they make these points so brilliantly because they show how slick an operation things are in Vegas on both sides. Like, you know, like the card counting, they got guys with mirrors and like remote things and they're doing telegraph and like doing wireless communication and stuff. Mm. And then they show once Nikki runs all those guys off, they show Nikki's crew. And they're like sitting at the same table being like, it's hard to carry two loaves of bread under your arm. Oh, I got three flat tires. What am I doing here? Like, it's the most obvious, stupid shit.
Uh-huh.
And Ace tries to say, it's like, come on. You know, if you're going to rob the casino, can you at least, you know, wear the garter belt? I just won't catch you, you know? Mm-hmm. But like there's gaming commission people hanging around and Nikki won't do it. Like what is his deal? Why does he have to do the most obvious? Why can't he? He's so artful in his smash and grabbing. Like he's doing stuff that nobody, like, you know, drilling holes through walls and knocking stuff, doing this. But like the casino, it's just he treats it like his piggy bank. That's the thing I don't get.
Yeah. I go back to Goodfellas. Like, are you going to make a guy like this? Right. And they say in this movie, he's a made man. So, you know, he can't be touched. And I think that's the thing that gives him the license to act the way he's acting, is that he knows he's untouchable. Mm-hmm. At the same time, why would you not just call that guy to the ceremony where you're going to make him and put a bullet in his head because he's more trouble than he's worth, right? Like, if he's acting that way before.
Yeah.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
One other thing, when we're talking about this kind of like three-way trust triangle of, you know, nightmare with Ace, Nikki, and Ginger, they set up this conundrum. I think this is the other flaw. I talked about the car blown up, I think, as a flaw. This is the other potential flaw, or maybe it's just fat in the movie. They established that, like, he gives Ginger control of his kidnapping money, like his bail money, like his, like, oh, shit, this is my only way out if I'm in a closet or I need... They don't ever do anything with that. Like, she cleans his box out, but he knows it's happening. He has tons of money. He's not currently in a pinch or a bind. I feel like that this movie is a long movie and it's very watchable, but I feel like you could pull 15, 20 minutes out of it. Some of this stuff doesn't go anywhere, but I wonder if Scorsese pulls that stuff in because it feels more real.
Yeah, I think you know? The box is like a detail that he uses later on, but he... you know, doesn't use it to the effect that most movies would. It's more just like, this is a part of this guy's life. And I don't understand, like, you're right when you say he's got a whole bunch of money. I don't understand his it's control. Like,
he
wants this $2 million when he's probably got 15 in the bank. I, like he's so concerned about this $2 million in this box that she's taken. It doesn't
seem he could
right.
probably one day's worth of big skimming. He could probably get that money back. If he, it'd be one thing if he was in the closet and it turns out she'd stolen it. Because I thought that's the first time I saw it. I'm like, that's exactly what's going to happen. Oh, my God. You're trusting this woman with your bail slash kidnap money.
Yeah, it's Walter White money in the crawl space, right? It's exactly that is what a lot of shows would do with this.
But it's just another, it's the final escalation of the control where he can't, you know, like it's I don't know, it's a microcosm because these cops that he owns are saying like, hey, Mr. Ace, we can't do anything about this. And he's like, well, she's drunk and she's driving and she's speeding. You can't pull her over while the feds are pulling her over. It's like,
it is.
I mean, I guess it works as a way to escalate. And maybe it's sometimes it's nice to subvert your audience's expectations. But I'm also like wondering, like, yeah, if you just pull another 15 minutes out of this movie, does it actually work better? Or do you need that last little bit of, you know, her ramming into his house and destroying his car? And
I like to think that that's Sherbert's car. That's Don Rickles' car that he's parked there
looking from the curtains. Like, it's my car. What? I'm always the one getting the fist. Why can't Ace ever get? Because like Ace never gets. That's the crazy thing is Ace never really gets a consequence. Like he's literally no worse or better off at the end of the movie than he was to begin it.
That's true. He's right back where he was.
He's right back where he was. He's got a kid, presumably, that I think he cares about genuinely. But I don't know.
Yeah,
it's wild.
The thing it does do with this money and stuff is it paints Sam as it colors in Sam's character. Like, you know, he's got all this money. He's got this lifestyle that where he could skim another $2 million in a week if he wanted. But he's so fixated on that, right? And it tells you that it's not necessarily about the money. It's something within Sam that's driving him for control over this woman, control over his own life. It does color the lines in a little bit on Sam.
Especially when he has that quote where he's like, there's three ways of doing things. There's the right way, the wrong way, and the way I do it.
Yeah.
Which is a hell of a statement because there's a couple of things in the movie. When he makes that point, the movie's been saying things like Sam does things uniquely. Like he's got this just so way of doing things and that's why he wins. Like, you know, he's meticulous, he's careful, he researches things. But then the second half of the movie is all about the way he does things and how wrong it is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting that like it doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong. It's just how I want things to be done.
Right.
And I think there's a little bit of that, like you can see the seeds of that in his relationship with Ginger that like kind of send that into a spiral. But I don't know, because like, you know, the other thing is like that's the thing I got on this watch is like the first watch, I'm just aghast at what Nikki's doing. I'm like, oh, my God, this is so dangerous. And this is so transparently a bad idea. And like every single time he's like, Nikki, if you run this red light, you're going to get pulled over and they're going to take you to jail. Ah, what? Red lights? I don't even think this cop's out here. Oh, I'm in the black book now. OK, well, I guess that's a problem. Well, you can't come to casinos anymore. Ah, fuck that. What do they know? They don't care. It's like it's just him completely transgressing over every line to Ace and saying, please, please just don't. It's just but like, I noticed this, how much Ace does the same damn thing. Mm-hmm. Like there's this point where like Remo or whoever the big boss is saying like, yeah, I still want Nikki to run. He's runs a good square shot, but he needs to take whatever job he does. He's got to keep it quiet. He's got to stay out of the spotlight. And they smash cut to him starting up this Vegas show that's going to be on national television so he can get a larger, more flamboyant platform to quote unquote fight back. And I'm like, you can't do it either, man. You can't do it either. It's wild. I feel like I've said it's wild 10 times because it really
is. Wild.
This movie is for a careful, cautious person. This movie is a goddamn, you know, jungle safari of bad ideas and big game that you don't got the ammunition to take out.
You know, speaking of taking things out, and this movie maybe could be 15 minutes shorter at least, Kevin Pollak, they could just remove him from this movie entirely and it would make no difference, right?
Yeah.
The only thing he does is get him some money from, and not even, he's like the patsy of this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And or the other way you could take it is build it out a little bit more, because I felt like the bookend of this film where Ace is essentially doing like Elliot Gould does in Ocean's 11. He's like, they're blowing up all my glorious casinos to put up these gaudy monstrosities. It's essentially that monologue.
He would have
right?
fit so perfectly in the fashion of this movie.
He sure would have. Well, that's the funny thing about it is like he literally is like, I think you're supposed to understand that is Ace Rothstein. He's trying to get his revenge against the guys that edged him out.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I gotta watch Ocean's 11 again now that I've got Casino under my belt, because I bet that's exactly what you're supposed to understand. But it just doesn't kind of work, because he says they don't connect the dots between, you know, the mob had their money and their patsies, and now big businesses come and they're selling junk bonds and people are going to lose their shirt, but they're going to get rich. And is that, you know, that's a good argument to make. Like, is that less moral? Like, is Vegas any less immoral now that it's Disney World than when it was in the 70s? Because they're still a vampire.
Yeah.
You know, like the Mafia Vegas was a Bela Lugosi or maybe even a Nosferatu horrifying vampire that didn't try to hide that it's trying to suck you dry. Whereas like New Vegas is Edward Cullen. They still like from Twilight, they sparkle, and but they're still going to suck you dry if you got warm blood.
That line at the beginning of the movie where they say like it's the last time street guys like us were ever given anything that valuable. So now the value... I don't know. It's interesting to me. Like the idea that Vegas could sort of spring up as this haven of, you know, the Mos Eisley, right? Of the world. Scum and villainy is located here. And it's a great time if you don't get too mixed up in it, if you just visit. But, you know, eventually that became too big to be sustainable. And the corruption and the crime and the just all of that became too much. And so the corporate interests came in, took the money making parts of it, took the scammy, shitty parts of it and Disneyfied it. And now they're just, you know, fleecing regular Joes who are coming in with their families and stuff. But I'm trying to think of another arena where crime or you know, it's like online is starting to become some of that. It's like there are underground mafia style groups who do things like online that are
move cash money or
locking down
people.
Local government computers and demanding payments shit like that. Moving drugs around and money and people, and that is online. And you wonder, like, when is that type of shit? Like, we already saw it, right? The internet is becoming Disneyfied in some ways, right? And monetized, over-monetized in those same ways. It's just, it seems like they forge a path ahead. And then corporate interests come in, take what they can that's legal enough from that and use it to make money for themselves.
Yeah.
Just it's a pattern.
It's weird though, because like I've only known Vegas since like its Disneyfication. I think the first time I went out to Vegas was like in the mid 2000s. But I've already can tell there's a huge difference between then and now. Like when I was showing up in 2005, man, if you were at the I'll brag a bit and say I've never left Vegas down. I've always taken Vegas.
Nice.
I owe Vegas about $3,000 and. Speaking of Nikki, he's trying to get me back for his 40th birthday to go out to Big Vegas Bash. And if I go, I bet that's when Vegas collects. Because I'll tell you what, it used to be that you had a sports book and you had tickets on your table. You never had to worry about drinks.
Right.
Now it's like getting a drink comped. Who you got to blow or kill to get a drink comped in Vegas? Like,
that's
it's
crazy.
One thing that the little rinky-dink Midwestern casinos doing that shit, but if you can't get a drink copped in Vegas, what the fuck? What the fuck? It's crazy.
It's to their advantage, too. The looser, the more drunk you are, the more money you're willing to blow on stupider and stupider bets. But the thing is,
I don't think that's true. Or if to the extent that it is, like the mafia guys would just be like, sure, yeah, keep them drunk, keep them, you know, if they're winning big, give them a penthouse suite so they come back and lose it all tomorrow. Because that's the thing, like Vegas doesn't care if you win; they love it when you win.
Yeah,
because you tell everybody. Vegas just wants you to keep coming back because you keep coming back, they will get you eventually. That's the way these odds work. So the mafia guys would just be like, yeah, give him girls, give him blow, give him booze, give him nice rooms, give him banquets, give him, you know, fucking tickets to go see Frank Sinatra. Whereas like the corporation's like, let's throw this into a spreadsheet and see how much a guy's got to lose till I got to give him a drink. And they got you on the car. That it's like you're a lab rat now instead of a mark. You've like, I guess I'd rather be a mark than a lab rat because, you know, lab rats, I'm just getting shocked and I'm getting fed. And like, who even knows? It's some kind of science thing. Whereas a mark at least has to glad hand me, you know.
And then, you know, there's also a certain amount of skim when you're not running an above board operation, you know, like, okay, well, get them drunk, keep them happy. Maybe that cost us a little bit in the long run. And, you know, if we were running this by the spreadsheet, we could be more efficient. But also you got the hustlers who are here, right? And they're going to spend money in the restaurants, the casinos. And if they can't hustle these drunken fools out of their money, then they're not getting paid, and we're not getting a part of that payment, and like it all comes back to us in the end. Yeah.
I thought that was really funny to show the way they showed a passage of time is like, you know, they establish this big beefy Italian guy goes in there with this big leather briefcase and just gets stacked with $100 bills. And by the end of the movie, it's like just this slim little envelope that gets slid across, and you can see the old guys in Kansas City are like having cows, like this is out of hand. What? It's funny because it just wasn't working anymore. It's the greed. That's the thing about the greed engine, man. It runs great until it starts eating itself, you know. And then what do you got to do? I kind of want to talk about the characters because I feel like we talked a lot about Ace, but we haven't talked about like Nikki and Ginger so much.
Okay.
I think this is my favorite Joe Pesci performance. Like, I do prefer it to what he's doing in Goodfellas because it really leans into the fact that like Joe Pesci's just a hilarious guy. Like, even when he's putting dudes like heads in vices, like he's worked this guy over for 2 days. This guy's in bad shape. This guy's head in a vice. He's like, you better give it. I'm gonna. And then when a guy finally does, he's like, I forget what the guy's name. Oh, Charlie M. He's like, Charlie M? You let me pop your fucking eyeball off for Charlie M? And he just goes crazy about it. Or he's got this restaurant. He's talking about this blonde about like how high class he is that he uses the milk fed veal. And he's explaining that to her as he's this worldly guy trying to impress this girl. He gets out in the car and has her just slide over. And just as he's explaining the veal, just pushes her head right onto his crotch.
Yeah, he does that twice. That's his go-to move.
It's his go-to move, man. That's how you know he's a romantic, you know?
Yeah, that's his version of stopping short.
And when he's doing a narration about, like, after he stopped getting permission from the bosses to whack people, and there's, like, this body count, like, they keep on showing just, like, this guy's with their brains blown out in the pool, and the guy with the brains blown out, and the cops are on him. He's walking out after his deposition, and he's, like, he talks to this guy like this. There's reporters walking with him. He's like, hey, you know, watch your step off this, step off the sidewalk. Wouldn't want you to slip on a banana peel and the cops come and ask. He's got this whole comedy show he's doing, even though he's killing, you know, he's filling more vacants than Snoop and Chris did in The Wire. It's hilarious. And him, like, I thought there was this really good scene he did where he runs off another mafia crew that's there to rob the casino. And he's like, because they all know each other and these guys are made men. Right. You know, like Ace can just hammer a guy. Mm. Like, you know, a guy comes around, but these are made men. So he comes up, it's like, hey, how you guys doing? Oh, yeah, we're looking for Carmen. Oh, yeah, Carmen? Oh, he actually went out the door 5 minutes ago.
Yeah,
oh,
he's in another place across the street. Yeah.
It's all this thing. It's like he has to be kind of like with a velvet touch because he can't just kill these guys. They're all made men. So he just lets them know. It's like, hey, you stick around, steal money, there's going to be it gives them this cover. Like, they have this conversation that means not. I don't even know if Carmen exists. It's just a way for them to diplomatically talk and figure things out and not have Nikki beat their brains in, which is going to cause a bunch of trouble.
And then he looks over at Sam after that conversation. And he's like, huh? Like he's behaving, right? He's the good dog who's.
And then that's why I think
he's the bad dog who's desperately trying to be good, you know?
Yeah. Like, it works out. Like you know, like Nikki says, like, this thing we had set up was so sweet, and we screwed it up. Because it was. It was the perfect, Yeah, he laid out in the first act. It's like, you know, Sam's got the perfect girl in his arm. He's the perfect guy to run the casino. He's got his best friend from the way back days that can keep an eye on things and make sure that he, you know, nobody messes with him. And we could have just ran that till the end of time, and they could have. But the greed engine. I don't know if I want to say much more. They have a little details, like the fact that Nicky loves his kid. He worships his child. Like, he's there to make him pancakes every day. And he's like really involved in the Little League. Who's a federal, was the coach of his Little League, like a federal agent or something. And,
his kid's name was Little funny. Nicky, which.
Yeah. Well, you know,
Adam Sandler ruined, but
I think he ruins it a couple years later. But, what do you want to say about Ginger? I mean, I think this is widely considered to be Sharon Stone's finest performance, if not like top three.
So she was nominated for best actress in a leading role for the Academy Awards. Didn't win, lost to Susan Sarandon in Dead Man Walking that year. But yeah, it's a great performance. It has a lot of range. You know, she can be sexy and seductive and smooth and well put together, and also a total fucking train wreck by the end of this movie.
Yeah, like some of the physical acting where they're like throwing her downstairs and like throwing her out and apart, like there's just a lot of physical acting that she's doing. And like the way she like I said, I can't imagine what filming this shit is like, where you're just like, you know what today we're gonna do, what we're gonna do today, we're gonna scream at each other until we're red in the face and spit is flying. And we're going to do this like 15 times. Like, how do you do it? It seems like a hostile work environment.
Yeah, it has to be. I guess you get a big hug after the scene is over, right?
Yeah. And just watching her spiral down. Cause I don't know what she's more addicted to. The other thing I kept on thinking on multiple watches is, why didn't Ace and Nikki just kill James Wood, man?
I think he knows that if he did that
into a pit,
he would lose Ginger for good.
Really? There's something that waited for like a quiet point to like, it's been a good month. And this guy, like, cause he's, the thing is like, I think that Ginger would probably believe this guy gets himself killed.
I think sure. Yeah. I mean, he's a low life.
He's not a smart man. Yeah.
Yeah. And a dumbass, and a hothead. I get the impression that like he could have done that very early on in the relationship. But I think if like, especially after they go to Beverly Hills or whatever and spend a bunch of money, if he had done it, then she would have known. Like, it's not something where she needs proof. Like, she would just know, right?
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, you could take the Rubik's Cube out to James Wood, because, like, what is he thinking? Like, he's really stupid.
Incredibly.
Like when he's, like, saying, he doesn't know where we're at. He's not outside. It's like, dude, he called you at your house. He knows exactly where you're at. You probably have five Joe Pesci's outside your back door. Or, I do think it's hilarious that the mafia execution squad's average age is like 73 years old. Did you notice that?
Yeah, when they're all these going dudes, to Costa Rica, all these dudes,
all these dudes clean and look like your dad, man.
For sure,
like
they do.
Now, yep. Like 2020, your dad, and they're like, "Come on, you jagoff, pow!" Like that was. There's no Luca Brasi. There's just like the it's the buffet club at Ponderosa coming to take you out, man. It's so funny.
They have the great equalizers, right?
It's true. The guns and the aluminum baseball bats, and the fact that these people trust you until they don't, you know?
Right. And that's the thing with Lester. I think like he's incredibly dumb and he just overestimates himself.
Too.
Yeah, Lester Diamond.
What a name.
It's a bad name. But it's a great name. I don't know. It's both.
Yeah, it's perfect for him. And James Wood, he's a terrible human being from everything I can tell, but he plays a good terrible human being in this movie.
Yeah. He just overestimates his own competence. He overestimates his own grandeur, like how important he is when he's dealing with these people who are so much more connected than he is.
Speaking of the geriatric hit squad, I love the scene where, you know, all the mafia old men, the Kansas City mafia, are finally kind of getting the heat, and they're brought in for, you know, to this court trial. and they're all like on oxygen. They're like, you know, they're on oxygen and they're on walkers. Like, oh, our clients are too old to stand trial. And then they get to the back room, and as soon as the door closes, they rip off their oxygen mask. And they do this thing where it's like they go down the table. It's like, okay, what do you think we're going to do about this guy? And they go down, and the guy's like, you know, I think Andy's a stand-up guy. He'd never betray us. He's served us for 50 years. Next guy's like, solid guy, Marine. We can trust on him. I think he's okay. The guy's okay. And then they get to Nemo, and Nemo's like, you know what I think? Why take the risk? But that's just what I think. A smash cut to him getting whacked. Like,
yeah.
There's something so just great about the way Scorsese shows that, like, it doesn't matter. You can do everything right. If the heat's on, it's time to liquidate. It's time to set everything on fire. It's time to burn those bridges and make sure those dead men tell no tales. And it's that's a part of the criminal movies that always give me a chill, that, like,
yeah,
that's what it means to be outside the law.
Mm-hmm.
There's no protection. There's no recourse.
Okay, I got a question about Ginger. It's more of a question about the operation of the Vegas, and they do a great job in this movie of kind of conveying, you know, how you said earlier, everyone's on the take somehow. Everyone's skimming out of everyone else's pockets. There's one dot that I can't connect, though, and it's the valet Parkers, because they make a big deal about how the Parkers pay, what is it? Parkers pay, take care of the security guards. Security guards take care of the Metro cops. Metro cops let them operate. She's like in with them. I don't understand why a valet Parker would be so important. And
I think when you're talking about, because what Ginger and Nikki both are looking for is whales, right? You know, that they can siphon off, and in Nikki's case is smash and grab their shit. How do they know the random people flying into Vegas? How do they know the high rollers from the mom and pop from Kansas that's just, you know, wanting to let their hair down?
You can watch the valets
you could do that, but the valets are the guys that are unloading the luggage and, like, taking it to their room and knowing what room they stay at. Like,
true.
It feels like that's the, like, they at the end point, it's like, hey, look, this, I just helped this lady. She got nice fur. She got diamond stuff. They got 17 big bags, and they stayed at the penthouse suite right away. No comp. Like, that's, they give them intelligence, I think.
Okay. And they do show a couple of scenes of that happening.
Yeah, like, you know, it's like, oh, did they check? Are they gone out of the room? And then Nikki's going to show up and rob him. And I think Ginger does the same, except for she siles up to him at a table and being like, hey, I'm your good luck charm. I that's the question I had, is like, how does the, with Elizabeth Shue, and like, how is being a high class grifter different from just being, you know, $1,000 an hour call girl? Mm-hmm. Or am I supposed to literally, is grifter literally just a euphemism for prostitute? Or is there, like, a class of woman who does, definitely that's the cover story, but it's a little bit more. Like, they're trying to get in there and ingratiate, like, steel chips. I don't know. Like, what's the difference between a sex worker and a grifter? Or hustler.
I feel like it's a subset. You know, it's like, not all grifters are sex workers. No, it's the other way around. Maybe, I don't know. I feel like that's a part of the job.
Are hustlers, but all hustlers probably include a little bit of sex work.
I think so. Yeah,
I could see that. The other thing this film does well is documents the history of how Vegas worked up until the early 80s, and I thought that was endlessly fascinating. Like, before you had widespread CCTVs, you had dudes up in the drop ceiling
with binoculars
going through one-way mirror, and stuff that I'd never even thought about. The casino licensing scam. Like, how do these wise guys get licensing? Well, the backlog to get a gaming license 10 years long, and it has to reset every time you get a job change. So you just go from being the director of entertainment to the director of food and beverage to the director of hotel and guest relations, and you just keep on playing that little shell game. And as long as you don't piss off the locals, you'll as long as you don't piss off the fucking turquoise cowboy boot crowd, you're going to be fine with that. The danger a whale presents to an unsophisticated casino owner, a guy with enough bankroll to bust your casino.
Yeah.
you know, like they showed like this Japanese businessman who had like taken down a couple of a casino in the Cayman Islands because they just have enough money that they can sustain a run of bad luck, and how, you know, Ace eventually bought him by, like, you know, this elaborate subterfuge of like, oh, the plane, you can't take off because the plane's having trouble. You know what? We'll comp you, give you $100,000 of chips, knowing that if they get this guy playing, that the odds will eventually get him back. I thought that was great. This is the way they showed the money, how it all, like the movie is hungry for money. It follows it, like literally follows the money as it goes through the casino, and you see every little bit, like how the dollars get peeled at the top. Even how the mafia takes, like, there's not an official system for doing it. They just go into the count room where they're not supposed to be, and the guys are counting, and they're not paying. It's just this dude just walks in, he goes to the cash box, and he takes him 30 seconds and he's gone. Like, it's just a really, it's like the first 30 minutes of this is like a documentary, like how shit gets made, Vegas edition.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? And I feel like, the Oceans movies perfected that, somewhere along the way, to where, like, it, you know, obviously it's the more honest side of the casino stuff. This has like the criminal element.
Right.
But I think, like, I don't know. It's one of those things where there's no cover here, right? It's all just like, it relies on everybody looking the other way. And as soon as you lift as soon as you open the curtain on this stuff, it all is shown to be just a scam. All of it.
That's what's so fun. That's what I love about, there's this one particular monologue or narration that Nikki's given when Sam tells him, like, this three loaves of bread under your arm bullshit, you know, stealing money from the blackjack table, openly counting cards on your fingers and toes is not going to happen. And he's like, I don't understand what Ace is getting so mad about. This is Las Vegas. We're supposed to be robbing. That's the reason we're out here. And it's like, that's a hard thing. That's, how do you argue against that? Like, hey, you're doing it the wrong way. You know, like, I mean, you can try that and it gets about as far as you think it gets with Joe Pesci. So,
right.
And then the other, like I said, I forgot to connect this dot, but the detail about everyone stealing and everyone mad about the person stealing from them, culminating into that guy that runs the Italian grocery store where all the money runs through in Kansas City, being like, these guys are robbing me blind. I'm going to start writing stuff down. And they just, that's just a one sentence throwaway in like the first act in the movie. And then as the second turns into the third, you see him with a binder full of criminal conspiracy mic'd up saying, this guy's stealing. And you see an FBI agent writing down this guy's name. And this guy, last time I talked to him, and it's just they can't see the noose tighten around their neck. Because as smart as Ace is, and as smart as like Nikki thinks he is, you're only as smart as the weakest link, man.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of weak links of this organization, turns out. But I love that. Like, the, you know, keeping notes for a criminal fucking conspiracy, Stringer Bell would say.
Not smart. All right, so we opened this podcast talking about which is better, Casino or Goodfellas. I think there's only one true way to judge, and it's to rank the apartments, the houses of Henry Hill and Sam Rothstein.
Oh,
which one is worse? And I think that movie probably wins.
Oh, the worst one?
Because I'm worst, like, apartment or house wins, yeah.
They're both kind of tasteless in their same way.
Yes.
Like, Sam's, Ace is running a little bit towards the Liberace end of tasteless, and Henry's running a little bit towards the New Jersey tracksuit, gold chain, you know, slick back hair end of tasteless. But I think Henry Hill's got the worst house.
Like, by far, yeah.
I had a physical reaction to him taking us through a tour of his third act house. Where, like, I kept on like, you know, I would never have that much clothes and that many watches and that many shoes, but I admire the garage that he has, like the systems he has to keep it all straight and all that stuff. It's like, you got to admire the efficiency. And like, yeah, some of Sam's stuff was sweet.
Oh, yeah. I love his front window, like, or back window. I forget which it is.
Oh, it's looking out of that golf course?
Yeah. I mean, he's just got this full picture window. One wall is just a window. It's cool.
It's beautiful.
I mean, the decor inside is atrocious, but not nearly as atrocious as Henry.
Front row views of the federal agents running out of fuel and landing on the golf course.
Yeah.
God, there's so many great scenes. That's another thing. So Pesci's just so funny. Like, these federal agents run out. They come scrambling with their little, like, walkie-talkies and guns, and they're going right past Ace, who's trying to have, like, this legit on-the-board, this intense discussion with the gambling board.
Yeah.
And Joe Pesci's like, hey, $1,000, whoever hits the plane first to goodbye. And there's, like, just, you can hear him, like, donking balls off the, it's so great. It's so great.
Yep.
Casino, baby, 25 years.
I think I'm ready to chill out a little bit on the gangster movies. Like, we've done this. We did Goodfellas. We did Irishman. We did Wolf of Wall Street recently. Like, I could take a break on this kind of stuff for a while.
2020, the year of the gangster, turns out, yeah. A bald move, which doesn't feel like it's entirely a terrible fit for this year that's been siphoning off so much of our psychic resources.
For sure.
Who's got their hand in my pocket? I tell you what, it's not the number of hands, not zero, I feel like, this year.
Yeah.
That's it for Casino. We'll be back next week for 1986's Labyrinth, which is the David Bowie, Jennifer Connelly fantasy vehicle. I've never seen this one. I've seen like bits and pieces of it. And, you know, who hasn't seen a couple of memes from Bowie from this film?
Sure.
And I feel like, because I know that came up a lot on the Harmontown podcast, because one year Jeff Davis, the co-host of the show, went all in on the Labyrinth theme. And I think they did a Halloween episode of Harmontown where they all dressed up as, what is it, Jareth?
Okay.
Yeah, Jareth is a David Bowie, like, King of the Goblins thing. And
did they wear the pants?
Some skits and stuff. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Jeff Davis. Yeah. He went all out and looked good doing it. But we'll be back. It's another commissioned podcast. So we got a fellow bald mover to thank for that one. We're going to do Labyrinth. I think we're going to be doing back-to-back commissions. It's looking like Labyrinth and then Return of the King to finish our Tolkien trilogy. But yeah, that's what you can look forward to in the weeks ahead. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.